You're listening to Seminars at Hadley. The following is a recorded discussion with Richard Bowles, the best-selling author of What Color is Your Parachute? Moderated by Hadley President Chuck Young.
Good afternoon and welcome to Seminars at Hadley. And our guest speaker today is the author, Richard Bowles, author of What Color is Your Parachute? Now in its probably 30th edition, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
And I'll give you a little bit of background, if I could, on Mr. Bowles. He is generally regarded as the world's foremost authority on the job or career search and how to help people find what their mission in life is. He's a graduate of Harvard University in chemical engineering and holds an advanced degree in New Testament studies from the General Theological Seminary in New York City.
Freudian,
right?
Yeah.
He has sold more than 8 million books.
Nine
million books now. See, the sales just went up, I think.
Yes.
And,
thanks to you.
Yeah. And the Library of Congress has selected him as one of the 25 most influential authors, or the author of a book that's one of the 25 most influential books on Americans' lives. And this year's What Color is Your Parachute addresses finding meaningful work and discovering your life's mission. So with that, I will start by asking you a few questions, if I can, Richard.
You can ask them.
Okay. All right. I asked a bunch of my blind colleagues and friends to forward me some sample questions. So here's what I got in the email. The first one is, the job search often concentrates on three things. The what do you want to do vocationally? The where do you want to apply your skills or where do you want to work? And finally, the how to get a job or a career. And Richard Bowles' book, in my opinion, concentrates predominantly on the what. Why so much emphasis on the what versus the how, like resumes and writing cover letters? Your work always seems to concentrate on figuring out what you want to be or what you want to do. So would you address that?
Well, that's one impression. Of late, I've heavily emphasized where. There's a whole new section in this edition on where. But to speak to your point, everyone starts out by saying, what do you do best? What are you best at? And I don't start there. I start with, what do you love to do the most? Because if you love to do it, you're going to inevitably be good at it. I remember one time as a young adult, I decided to take up tennis, and I got skunked in the very first match, and I never took up tennis again. I didn't enjoy it because I was losing. Likewise, people, when they start out trying to say, what am I best at, they often choose a subject or a set of skills that they really don't enjoy. And so you have a heavy resistance when you first start talking about what do you want to do with your life to get them out of that mentality. And the one way I've chosen to get them out of that mentality is to talk about what are the skills you enjoy using the most. And because there's a lot of resistance to this whole idea that, well, I may enjoy it, but that doesn't mean I'll be good at it, I heavily emphasize that, and I have to deal with not only defining the concept in their minds, but also getting over the resistance that they feel to this whole idea of enjoyment as a key to their life's mission and their life's work. And when I define it, I say, what deals with transferable skills? And transferable skills are not the ones that people most often think of. They say, well, I'm very patient. That's not a transferable skill. That's a trait. Or they say, I'm very persistent. Again, a trait. So we have to start fresh and say, well, what is a transferable skill? And simply defined, a transferable skill is something you are good at doing in one field, but which you can easily take and use in another field. And hence, they turn out to be gerunds. They turn out, in terms of grammar, they turn out to be verbs that end with ing, analyzing, organizing, synthesizing, gathering, and so on. So there's a heavy emphasis in the book on what, because if we can get them to understand that they're like travelers, they're going out into the world and they're going to travel. They're not going to go from one geographical place to another, but they're going to go from one set of interests or feels into another, and their suitcase is already packed. The suitcase is packed with their transferable skills. They're going to find it very easy to go into another field if only they have inventoried what is in the suitcase, what they're taking with them as they move to another field. And so this has proved to be very productive if we start there. Now, they like to start at the other end. They like to start at where. And I say, no, let's start with what.
Okay. Now, you brought up what I call the pain avoidance theory. People tend to do the things that are joyful to them and avoid things that are painful. You used an analogy. Mm-hmm. You tried tennis and it was a painful experience. Mm-hmm. You gave it up. Yet, and people do that in their recreation or leisure activity, they'll go out and find things that they enjoy and do those things.
Right.
But they seem to let that go all out the window when it comes to the job. Like, they seem to never think about that in occupations.
Right.
You know, why don't they apply that same theory to what they do for a living?
Because they're supposed to suffer.
That's why they call it work.
According to the Puritans, who have had a heavy hand on our history, for the two people who babysit, one loves babysitting, the two teenage women or girls, let's say, one loves to babysit and the other one hates it, and we say, who do you think is the more virtuous? 9 times out of 10 people say, oh, the girl that hates it. But that's not true. The virtue is in loving to do what you're doing.
Okay. Informational interviewing. You seem to be the guru that discovered or at least perfected the art of informational interviewing.
No, I invented it.
You did. Okay.
Yeah.
I was trying to be kind.
I knew you would.
Yeah.
Don't give them too much credit. But
why do you put so much emphasis on informational interviewing?
Because everything is changing out there. Let me step back just a moment to say what informational interviewing is. It is going out and talking to people who are doing work that you think you'd like to do. Now, as misconstrued, which it frequently is, informational interviewing is considered to be a trick to get in to see an employer. You say, I'm here to learn some information about blah, blah, blah. And then while you're there, you say, oh, by the way, I'd be very interested in working here. And so it's been a more mangled concept in the field of life work planning you could not find. And therefore, I want to emphasize what it is. It's testing. It's trying on a suit or a dress before you buy it. That's all it is. It's saying, I think I would like to do this, but I don't know that I would like to do that because I don't really know what they do. I'll give you a good example. Suppose you decide you want to work for an airline, and they decide to assign you to the front desk in the airline terminal where you're selling tickets. Your dream was you'd be flying through the skies, and instead you're chained to this desk, and half the time you're doing data processing, like figuring out what all the tickets were about and all the destinations and stuff. And you say, I thought I would be flying through the skies helping people. So unless you go and talk to somebody who's actually doing the work you're attracted to, you don't know what it's really like. Informational interviewing is designed to correct that. There are other places where, in theory, you could go. You could go to the Internet, and they have a couple websites on the Internet do actually try to tell you what it's like to be X or what it's like to be Y. But there's nothing like face-to-face. And we recommend 4 questions when they do go out informational interviewing. The first one is, what do you like best about this work? Second one is, it's opposite, what do you like the least about this work? The third one, which is a gold mine of information, how on earth did you get into this? And the last one is, who do you think I should go talk to that could tell me more information about what it's like to do this job? Now, the reason informational interviewing gets twisted starts at the very inception. And that is, they go to see an employer. And you can't do informational interviewing with an employer unless you want to be the CEO of that particular group or organization. So you're talking to people who are actually doing the work, and it's amazing how you can sift through the stuff that's just an illusion about the job and the stuff that's actually real. Books can't tell you. They don't keep up. I got a letter not long ago from a guy who was a chemical engineer, and he was referring to the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which was the big authoritative volume on every kind of job. And he said, I only wish a chemical engineer did what is described in that manual. So often the manual is so far off the beam, so you can't really rely on the internet, you can't really rely on books, but you can rely on face-to-face if you've gone to see between 3 to 5 people. Because somebody may be so dead wrong, and they'll swear up and down that they're telling you exactly how it is, and it's not. They're just wrong. But when you do 3 to 5, you get a pretty good cross-section of opinion. And it's very helpful in avoiding jobs where you say, oh, I don't know whatever possessed me to think I would be happy in this job.
Okay, it sounds simple. If you want to go into a certain career before you leap, you should go talk to people that actually do that job.
You better talk to them.
Okay. Yeah, 3 to 5 of them, so you get more than one opinion, correct?
Correct.
All right. It seems so simple. Why are people so resistant of doing it?
Well, the first thing is they feel like they're using people. Uh-huh. And the second is they're shy. They did a survey. Phil Zimbardo, a professor at Stanford, is the expert on shyness. He wrote a book, which very inventively was called Shyness. And he found out 75% of all people said at some point in their life they were painfully shy. Now, I add, that doesn't account for the people who were too shy to tell him they were shy. So I think it's an even larger percentage than that. But in any event, everyone has had some of this experience, and of course it comes back. It comes back a lot, where they're fearful of going to see people. And so the neat thing about informational interviewing is that you can go with somebody.
You can go with somebody?
Yeah. Take your mother if you want.
Wouldn't that be a little strange?
No.
Okay.
No. You're going on informational interviewing, and you underline to the people you're going to see, you're underlining to them that you're not finding a secret way to look for a job. Because you don't bring another person with you when you're really going to go for a job interview.
Okay. All right. How important do you think is attitude versus skills in the job search or to be successful in a career? Your attitude about your employment versus your actual skill to do the job. What's the difference?
I have the foggiest notion.
Okay.
Bad attitude will kill everything, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
Sometimes people... I don't remember much of my high school or college math, but I do remember QED. I don't remember what it stands for, but it was always at the end of a long, convoluted formula, and what it meant was, which was to be proved. And there are a lot of people who set about the job hunt with very low self-esteem or with other problems, and they sort of unconsciously manipulate the job hunt so that it doesn't come out well. And then they say, see, that's what I knew was going to happen, QED. And so everybody has to look at their attitude and say, do I think I'm a valuable person to be here on earth? Do I think that I am unique? Do I think that God put me here for some reason, and that reason is something I need to discover? If they start to examine basic assumptions and they say, yes, I do believe all those things, now my task is to go and find out what are the unique gifts God has given me for this mission he intends, then you have a good attitude. If you start out with exercises that build your self-esteem, you're fine. What most people do is they send out a resume, which is guaranteed to sink their self-esteem, because the myth is that's how you go job hunting in America. In fact, out of every 1,470 resumes floating around out there, only one leads to a job. But nobody knows that except you and me. So therefore, and whoever may read the book. So the point is that a resume is guaranteed to sink your self-esteem because you have friends. You always have friends who did it, and it was like a cakewalk. They got exactly the job they wanted and so on. And they're very quick to point this out to you. I got a nice job by sending out my resume. What's wrong with you? So the self-esteem tends to dive. When you start out by identifying instead transferable skills and figure out what your armament is, that builds up your self-esteem. And attitude you can categorize and divide it 18 ways to Sunday, but basically attitude is, do I think I'm worth it? Do I think I'm a valuable person? Or do I think that I can walk out under the door without opening the door? What, how highly do I feel about myself? And everyone's always afraid in our culture about egotism. They say, well, if I think too highly of myself, people won't like me. So I always say, look, when you're trying to talk about self-esteem, you're trying to talk about, are you making a fair evaluation of yourself? Let's talk about antiques. You have this old Chippendale desk in your house, and you decide to get rid of it, and you put it out in some auction or a place where it can be sold, and somebody offers you 5 times what it's worth, and you say to yourself, I can't do this to them. I mean, I'd be taking advantage of them. I have to ask for a fair value for the desk. On the other hand, somebody may say, I'll give you $5 for that desk, and you say, no, I'm not going to do that either. Self-esteem wanders all over the lot like that. Bad self-esteem, which is masquerades as good, is you have an inflated opinion of yourself 5 times what you really are justified in saying about your worth on earth. And that's called egotism. Then there's low self-esteem, which is offering $5 for yourself. What you need instead is a fair evaluation of yourself. That's what self-esteem is. And the way to be sure you're getting that is to look at the people around you and think of all the gifts you see that they have and mention those gifts to people. So you're like a member of an orchestra and you're telling the piccolo player and you're telling the fife and you're telling the violinist, you're really important because you see yourself as not able to really function unless you're in the orchestra, unless you're surrounded by the other players. Try to be a piccolo player and play Tchaikovsky's violin concerto. It can't be done. So you guard against overweening pride and egotism by taking care that not only do you seek a fair opinion of yourself, but you seek a very fair appreciation of all the other people that you meet. And that way you keep the balance and keep yourself with good self-esteem, but not with egotism. And all attitude revolves from that.
Okay, you talked about skills and you talked about gifts. Do people know what their skills are? Do people know in general, do you think, what their gifts are?
No.
Why not? And how would they go about finding what their gifts are?
Well, I'll tell you about a woman I knew. She could walk into a room. There would be as many people in the room as here. And she would look around and walk out of the room. She would immediately describe who was leaning on their elbow, who was sitting up straight, what they were wearing, what the jewelry pieces were, what kind of hairdo they had, and she'd never miss a person in the room. She thought everyone could do that. It never occurred to her. It was a gift. We don't compare notes. One time I went to an allergist and he said, do you have trouble breathing when you wake up in the morning? Are you all stuffed up? And I said, yeah. And he says, that's not normal, but how would you know? And I thought, yeah, I don't go around asking people, is your nose stuffed up in the morning? I didn't have any fixture on what was normal and what isn't. And many people don't have a fixture on what their gifts are. You know, it just doesn't happen.
I agree. So how do they find out what their gifts are?
You mean you want me to work through the exercises?
I do. I'll give me some examples of how people would go about figuring out what their gifts are, okay, what their talents are, if they don't know them.
All right. You set a goal for yourself which you do not immediately realize. That is, you do not try to encompass it all at once. The goal is to write out 7 stories about yourself where you really were enjoying yourself. But you don't write the 7 stories at once. You write 1 story sometime in your life from the time you were born until now when you were doing some work you really love to do. When people fail to do that, they say, how can I come up with a good story? I can't think of one. I always say, why don't you take a lesson in writing? Take a piece of paper and start writing anything. And they say, well, what do I write? I say, anything. Well, I can't think of what to say. That's what you write. I can't think of what to say. And then my next thought is, this process is too difficult for me. This process is too difficult for me. And finally, you get it going. You just put anything down as utterly irrelevant. But as long as it's going on in your mind, that's what you write. Ultimately, you start to get freer and freer and freer, and you start to think of a story. One test of a good story is simple, and that is, did you lose track of time? When you were a kid, the example would be, did your mother have to call you to supper because you were really engrossed in whatever it was you were doing? If you start out by writing a story that the only criteria is, was I enjoying myself? You then analyze that story in terms of a series of typewriter keys, I call them, in my book. They're people skills, skills with things, skills with data. And you read each skill and you say, did I use that skill in this story? And if so, you color a little box. There's seven little boxes underneath. You color the first little box. If not, you leave it blank. When you get to the second story, then you say, no, you know, that wasn't that satisfying because I didn't learn that much about what my skills are. So we then say, okay, pick a place where there was a time in your life when there was a challenge, some kind of obstacle. You had a goal, an idea of what you wanted to achieve, but you had to get over that obstacle. And then you figured out a way around it or over it or under it, and it came out okay. So talk about the result. And then finally, quantify it. Can you put it in terms of any kind of accomplishment in terms of figures, money, whatever? A good example would be, I'll take one from my own life because I know it very well. I needed to travel. I had a family with four small children. I was as poor as a church mouse. Naturally, I was working for the church. So I tried to figure out, how do I get the children and my wife out on the road so we can have a nice vacation? And I finally figured out, I'll put a top on my station wagon. I hammered and made this weird contraption. It was a second-story Plymouth. And in the top story, I put a food cabinet. I put a bed for two of my kids. I put a dirty clothes hamper. I put a bureau with six drawers and so on. One picture of it is in my book, incidentally. All right, so there it was. I wanted to travel. That was my goal. What was the obstacle? I couldn't afford to. How did I get around it? I built a second-story Plymouth. Now, how do I quantify that? Oh, I think I saved maybe $797 that year that I would otherwise had to spend on motels and so forth. Now, that's a better story than the first story, just when I was enjoying myself. And you write five more stories in turn. It's helpful if you're doing it with two other people, so you each can say what you heard the skills of in each of their stories as well as your own. You go around round robin seven times. And it's amazing what you end up with. You end up with, first of all, humility, because you keep thinking to yourself, I've lived inside this skin all these years. I know myself. I don't need to be doing this silly exercise. And then you look at it and you say, oh, my Lord, I didn't know I was so talented. You really begin to see, every single person begins to see that they have immense number of skills they never took seriously, never stopped to think about. And so you end up with a list, and you prioritize the list. What's a skill you love to use the most? You look underneath the typewriter keys to see which key had seven boxes colored in. What that means is that skill kept showing up again and again repetitively, and you get a wealth of information about yourself, and in addition to that, your self-esteem starts to rise like a balloon.
So it builds you up rather than like testing that oftentimes tears people down.
Testing doesn't tell you who you are. It tells you what family you belong to. So you belong to the blue family in one test. You belong to the SRI family in another test. You belong to the ASX family in another test. All that says is the number of people who answered the same answers as you did tend to have these characteristics. Now, you know that, so that's the characteristics of the whole family of people that answer the test that way. But you know there are mavericks in every family. I remember I was very, very right-brained in a totally left-brained family, and my dad had a rich sense of humor, and I was the subject of the humor most of the time. And he said, you know, I'll never understand you. He laughed himself sick, saying, I'll never understand you. But it amused him. Well, when you take a test, you may get the summary of how other people answered it, but you won't necessarily get a summary of you. You have to say, do I belong to that family and to what degree, or am I really a maverick? So testing isn't anywhere near as useful as doing the kind of thing I was saying.
So you're saying you sit down and you write 5-7 stories.
Not at once. Because your choice will be awful if you write all seven at once.
And my experience from this is people try to write a story like The Day I Saved New York City. You know, they try to come up with an incredible story, and that's
well. First, find out, did they?
My point is, they struggle too hard to try to come up with some spectacular story. They have to do is say, "What's the best thing that happened to me during my 2 years in junior high?" And then write a story. Or what's the thing I most remember enjoying doing when I was in high school?
Yeah.
And write that up.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you're writing about times when you were happy, and then you go back, and it helps to have two other people go back with you. And you dissect that story, and you look for action verbs, ing things, as you call them, so that you can start to begin to recognize your skills. And when they appear in story after story, you have to conclude that, yes, I'm good at this.
But that's not a sufficient answer,
okay?
You have to conclude, I enjoyed this. Uh-huh. You might have a skill you code it seven times and you hate it.
Right.
I raised 300% of any financial goal I was ever given in any church I ever served. I hated raising money. I mean, the fact I was good at it didn't mean a hill of beans.
So a simple thing is to write stories and then dissect them and look for the skills that you enjoy using.
That's correct.
That you possess.
Yeah, you pick them out of the ones that colored a lot. They're probably there.
Somewhere. And everybody has skills. Everybody in this room.
I haven't met anyone that doesn't. Okay. You know what I say about the handicap, but for anybody listening that doesn't know what I say about the handicap, I say, look, let's talk about how many skills there are in the world. Nobody knows how many skills, transferable skills there are, so let's make up a number. Let's make up 2,731 skills in the world that describe what everyone has in one degree or another. How many skills do you think the average person has? Well, we don't know, so we'll make up a number. We'll say 731. Okay. That leaves 2,000 skills that you don't have, every one of us. There's 2,000 things each of us cannot do. So the only question is, how do we focus on what it is we do and do well and not keep our attention riveted on the things we cannot do? And that is the key to figuring out what you can contribute to the world.
So you figure out what are these skills that you possess, that you're good at, your gifts, and then you've got to take those and figure out where could you use those in an employment setting.
Correct.
In an industry that you would enjoy working in, an industry, occupational cluster, what have you. Okay. With that, I think we should ask if there's any questions from our audience, because you stole my notes in the illustration.
How can good self-esteem be observed or seen through one's behaviors?
You mean what are the marks of somebody that has good self-esteem, I assume?
Well, I'll just read the question here that somebody had submitted. How can good self-esteem be observed or seen through one's behavior? So I guess how would you act that would demonstrate that you do have good self-esteem?
Well, the first way would be loads of appreciation for everyone that you contact, work with, live with, where you give loads of appreciation, where in a marriage you thank them for doing the simplest things, where you try as hard as you can to always see the uniqueness of the other people and not just brush by them as we so often do in this culture. And then the second is, sometimes people will do all that, but they still think they're lower than a carpet tack. So the second is that you get comfortable with talking about yourself and what it is that you do and do well. You say, well, I'm really good at analyzing. Let me see what I can do about that problem. Where you don't hide behind how well you think of others and the fact that you don't think very highly of yourself. There has to be that balance.
Yes. I'm Roy Dubriel from Kissimmee, Florida. Did you say that it was not the thing to do is to take someone with you to an interview?
You cannot take somebody with you if it's a particular kind of interview. If it's an interview where you are trying to find out if they, the people you're talking to there or the one person you're talking to there, if they need what you have by way of talents and skills and experience, when you're in that, that's called a job interview. It's still data collecting. You're not trying to sell yourself. You're trying to find out, is this a place where I would like to work as much as they're trying to find out, is this a person I would like to have working here? So it's like dating. You're both sizing up each other and seeing if you want to kind of go steady. But the interview that I was talking about is another kind of interview altogether, and that is informational interviewing, where you're not talking to an employer or anyone that has the power to hire you, but where you're talking to somebody that's doing the kind of work you think you would like to do, which maybe you've never quite done in that fashion, and you want to find out what that job is like. That's an information interview. Now, if it's a job interview, you cannot take anyone along. But if it's an informational interview, you certainly can.
What about self-motivation and stuff like that? Like, you know, motivating yourself to actually find employment and stuff like that. I'm 22 and I've been out of school for 3 years and I haven't really found a job yet. So I'm wondering about what you think about that.
Oh. What kind of job have you been looking for?
I'm not sure. That's the thing. I really am not sure. When I was in high school, I didn't take co-op or anything like that. I'm really not sure what I would enjoy doing.
Have you ever tackled any of the exercises in a book called What Color Is Your Parachute?
No, I have never. Actually, I've never even read your book.
Might I recommend that as your next step out of despair? A whole series of exercises there that can help you immediately to focus what you're looking for. You have to know what you're looking for before you really realize success in your job search. Do more homework on yourself than you have to do on what's available out there in the job market.
I just like to add, that's why so much of this book concentrates on the what you want to do with your life. It's pretty hard to get motivated to go out of job interviews if you don't know what you want to do. So the more you know about what you want, the more enthusiasm you'll have for going out to find it.
Okay, what about if self-motivation isn't one of your strong points? What would you say to that?
I'm not sure what you mean by self-motivation, but I'll tell you a story and you tell me if this is hitting the target. I knew a woman who was a journalist for a magazine, and she was married to a lawyer. And the lawyer kept year by year noticing they were moving him around in the organization, and every time they moved him, he was in a smaller room than the room before. And eventually it was getting so there was barely room to walk around his desk. And in the room he found himself in. And his wife said, you've got to think about your career. And he said, well, they're okay. That's all right. So she came home, and she bought my book, and she read it. And every time they had dinner, she read him another chapter after dessert or even during the meal, for all I know. And she kept asking him some of the questions or exercises that are in the book, and he kept answering them. And eventually, he decided, no, I don't want to be in a room that's smaller every year than the room before. And he moved, and moved very successfully. Now, he's somebody I would not call self-motivated. But when she took an interest and became an advocate for him, he responded to what she did. So if you deal with a problem and we say there's no self-motivation here, then you have to link up with somebody that can help you and urge you and coach you and be a cheerleader for you. That's how you get around that problem in general. If I haven't hit your question, come back at me.
Okay, just we're going to take one question that's come through. The question is, how to help in improving adolescent self-esteem with behavior problems?
Why don't you answer that?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Adolescent self-esteem is one issue.
It's apparent.
And it's behavior problems is another issue.
This is apparent.
Oh, okay. Then you take it.
No.
I think
teenagers are another world. Trust me, I raised four of them. They live in their own world with their own boundaries and their own rules and so on. And I remember I knew a teenage psychiatrist. He worked solely with troubled teenagers. And he said, mostly what I do is I sit and listen to them and I wait for time to take its course. He said, they straighten out half their problems on their own without your raising a hand to help them in any way, shape, or fashion. What they most need at that age is good listeners. And if they puncture their ears or their tongue or they come home with a tattoo, just act interested. Don't try to start being the warden, because what they need most of all is somebody who will continually listen and they feel free to talk to. And much of lack of motivation or self-esteem or whatever in teenagers, just give it time.
What I meant by self-motivation is basically, you know, getting up off your ass and looking for a job as opposed to waiting for someone to help you find a job. That's what I mean.
And what's the problem?
Problem is I'm not exactly that great at actually getting up and looking for work. I've tried. I've applied to a few different places. I went to a job interview, and in the job interview, they were asking me questions that had nothing to do with the job.
Yeah, well, you went to a bad employer. You must always keep in mind, when you are going on any interview that has anything to do with looking for a job, you have the right to reject them as much as they have the right not to hire you. And if you keep that in mind, then you get back some of the power that otherwise you were going to give to them. A friend of mine in Switzerland says there's only two attitudes you can go into a job interview with. One is as job beggar. The other is as resource person. Resource person means you realize you would really be a resource for them. Either you've got brains that they haven't got, or you know something that they don't know, or you're more willing to keep at the task than anybody else they've got there. That's a resource person. You act as a resource for what it is they're trying to do in their organization. Job beggar, on the other hand, is sort of saying, boy, if this works out well, maybe they'll give me some crumbs off their table. And you beg wine or do whatever you need to try to get the job. But mentally, you've handed all the power over to the employer when you go as a job beggar. If you go as a resource person, you realize, maybe I'll fit here. Maybe I'm the kind of person they need, maybe I'm not. If I'm not, I'll keep going until I find a place that really needs the resources I have to offer. But you don't give your power over to the employer. You keep just as much of it to yourself as the employer keeps.
In my experience as a career counselor, the biggest reason why people don't find employment in our society is they give up. They get discouraged. They go on one or two interviews, and they don't get hired. And they think everybody else does. The fact of the matter, the job search is a series of no, 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 yes. And you have to be willing to work harder at the job search than you are actually on the job. And most people get discouraged. They think everybody else gets a job just like that. And the fact of the matter, it's a very intense, laborious process. The average person in our society is unemployed for 9 months. I had a friend of mine who was a lawyer that quit his job working for a law firm, and I offered to give him your book, and he didn't think he needed it. I said, are you prepared to be out of work for 9 months? He said, well, I'm a Yale graduate and a lawyer. I said, are you prepared to be out of work for 9 months? And 8 months later, he read the book. And so it's a very discouraging process, and a lot of people give up. I say they could become the third bar stool on the left. You can walk in the tavern. You can find them in the same spot every day feeling sorry for themselves. They think everybody else has an easy time, gets a job like that. The truth of the matter, it takes people months to find a job. They always say it takes at least a month for every every $10,000 you expect in salary. So if you want a $60,000 a year job, you should be spending at least 6 months working on it.
That, however, has turned out to be a myth.
Okay, go for it.
Well, I'll tell you why it's a myth. Somebody was a friend of mine who's a very well-known researcher in this field, and years ago, when this book was as young as a babe, I went and called him up, and I said, Saul, you're the expert in the country on this. I'm trying to find out how many employers there are. How many places can you go to look for a job? And he says, nobody knows, but tell you what, make up a figure and attribute it to me. And so that's how some of these statistics get born. One person one day said, I believe it takes 1 month or week or whatever for X number of thousands of dollars, and there's no proof for that. Nobody's ever tried to challenge it or whatever. It's just one of these myths that floats around out there. But it has a point, and the point is the higher you aim, the harder it is to find the job, the more time you have to allow for it, for the hunt.
And you can't give up.
That's an interesting thing. They found out that over one half of all job hunters give up within 2 months. Now, they've also found out why. That happens to be people that are using only one method of job hunting. There are, you can count them in different ways, but there are at least 14 different ways of looking for a job. And they tend to rest on resumes, especially since the invention of the Internet. They tend to say, I'm going to post my resume on Monster or Career Builder or Hot Jobs, and boy, the offers are going to come tumbling in. And if you only rely on one method, never mind what the one method is, you tend to give up within 2 months because you put all your eggs in one basket and you have depended on that basket producing and it didn't, and you give up. The minute you introduce another method of job hunting, the amount of sustaining energy that the people give to the job hunt gets longer. It gets longer by 3 months, 4 months, because they have alternatives. And when one doesn't work, they try the other. So people do drop out of the job hunt, but there's a specific reason why they do that can be remedied.
Mr. Bowles. My name is Charmaine Corbett, and I'm from Fayetteville, North Carolina. I am a business administrative graduate, and I've been graduated for almost a year. During the year's time, I've been looking for a job, and I've been accepted on many interviews and have done extremely well, but I just cannot seem to land the job. And one of the things that I feel that is a hindrance is because of the disability and the experience. So I want to know, what do you think I should do?
I have a couple of questions to ask you. When you're asked a question in an interview, what's the longest you take to answer any one of those questions?
So what the question is, if they ask me about myself or like what I like to do, I know that right off. If it's something to do with some type of formulas or different regulations and something, I may take a little bit longer, maybe at least about a minute.
All right. Next question. When you're in the interview, what percentage of the time do you feel you're talking, and what percentage of the time do you feel the employer is talking?
So 50-50. Sometimes in some interviews, the employer does more talking than I do.
Next question. What is it you're trying, what kind of job are you trying to find? What kind of work are you trying to find?
Mostly in entry-level management or some type of office assistant job. In fact, I do part-time right now with Pope Air Force Base, and I'm basically looking for a full-time, you know, type job.
Oh, you know, you're tripping across one of the mysteries of job hunting, which is, why do people turn down people? Are you going after large employers? What size organizations are you looking at?
Mostly small businesses or startup, or usually businesses that have been there for an amount of years, but they're kind of small businesses.
You want to speak to that?
Well, there's several things that come to mind. First of all,
the power of volunteering and temporary services. I hate to suggest this to people because they misread what I'm saying. When I, particularly people with disabilities, when I suggest that they volunteer, they interpret what I'm suggesting is that they don't have the skills to be hired somewhere, and therefore they ought to volunteer. And that's not what I'm suggesting. The best way to demonstrate skills and ability is through volunteering and temporary services. It's an incredible, powerful tool. I've had thousands and thousands of blind people over the years that I've told to volunteer who rejected the idea first and or used temporary, who came back to me a year or two later and said they volunteered and got a full-time job. It's a way, when you have a significant disability like blindness, you deal with a problem with credibility. You don't have credibility in the eyes of too many employers. It's not that you're not competent and capable, is they don't think you're competent and capable. So the best way I've seen for people to get around that is to volunteer or work with temporary services to show that they have the capability, and therefore they gain the credibility. The credibility is not on the part of the blindness, it's by the perception of the employer. So in your situation, I would suggest you take advantage of those two things, temporary services and volunteering, and I would suspect that you'll get a job in world record time.
I just have a question. If you say that volunteering is important, and I suppose that's true, but if you can't even get past the people that you want to volunteer for and convince them, I mean, how do you manage that? I've offered to volunteer for every organizations in this town, and they're like, oh, well, we just can't use you, or we really don't think, or that, or they want to turn me into some sort of charity case, which has kind of turned me off of the idea of volunteering. Or in a couple cases where I have applied to like volunteer for like AmeriCorps Vista, they can't find positions for me.
I would just suggest that you just keep persevering. There's got to be opportunities out there for you. And I just can't help but feel that perhaps you're dealing with the wrong organizations, the wrong people. I suggest consumer organizations of and for the blind as a way to help people better explain themselves, introduce them to employers or to volunteer opportunities. They're more accepting, but it's just a matter of persevering. I just think there's got to be opportunities for everybody to volunteer.
What size town are you?
Yes, I'm curious to know, first of all, you're talking about running into prejudice, and God knows it's everywhere, but it tends to be concentrated in some places more than others. I'm curious to know, as an aside, what size town or city are you talking from or are you looking for work in?
Oh, it's a small college town. It's not really that large.
College town, universities, college, I found probably the best people I've had experience working with for volunteer opportunities. There's, you know, college and universities usually have exceptional opportunities. So I would hope you would give the university or the college in your community a chance if you haven't already. But usually that and hospitals are another good source of volunteering. And perhaps you could also consider looking into temporary service employment in your community.
I just want to say that I did exactly that for almost 9 months, and the way that I ended up finding a place to volunteer was through friends and acquaintances, and they were able to get me into places that I could not get into myself, and I think that volunteering is really a great way to start.
Hi, this is Susan Gustafson. I've been volunteering at the School for the Blind and the library, and also the Southwest Washington Medical Center and the Foundation Office. I'm not sure I want a real job. I don't know at 56 if I'm too old to be considering new employment.
First of all, you're very bright. That's absolutely true. So much is invested in our concept of the word work. You know, John Crystal, who is my mentor about 2,000 years ago, when dinosaurs were still roaming the earth, he used to say, what is it about work you don't like? So with what you just said, I'd say sit down and write out a list of what it is that's superior about the temporary job or the volunteering, that is different? What is, if you were to go to work, what is it about work you don't like? And then he would have them, anyone that said that kind of thing, have them write up a paragraph saying, if work means, and you'd put all the negatives down, he said, then I want some other kind of way to use my skills. And often by focusing on what they didn't like about the world of work, it sharpened the kind of organization they then went looking for.
I see. I was a dental hygienist for 33 years, and I didn't have 1 minute of free time. So I think it's the discipline involved.
People who are struggling to figure out what they want to do, one of the things you can do is write down what you don't want to do. What's the worst job you ever held? And write it down on one side of the sheet. Everything you hated about the job, what was the worst part of it, and then after you get done, you know, writing it all out about what you hated about this employment, and then on the opposite side of the paper, just write, what's the exact opposite of that? In other words, you know, the job was outside and you hate, you know, then the opposite would be inside, or the job required sitting all day, so you obviously want a job where you can move around. So a lot of people know what they don't want to do, but most people don't know what they do want to do. So one way to approach that is to write out what you don't want to do and elaborate on it a great deal, and then sit down and figure out what is the exact opposite of that.
Hi, Richard. This is Sam. I was intrigued by your concept of deriving your purpose and your self-worth by determining what you have to contribute to an ensemble, and I was wondering if you could expand on that and maybe talk about how you go about doing that when you're in an isolated type of environment where you're looking for work.
Well, I wasn't so much talking about an ensemble at work. It's more an attitude about life that I was praising. You know,